The Guardian. Science Weekly is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. See for yourself. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GUARDIANSCIENCE to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Imagine being able to know how another person thinks and feels and will respond just by looking at their face and the way it's structured. What an advantage. And it's one you've just gifted yourself with.
The Roman statesman Marcus Cicero once said, "The face is a picture of the mind with the eyes as its interpreter."
About yourself and every single person around you than you ever thought possible. Face reading's been around for as long as anyone can remember. The science of how skull and facial features influence human behaviour has been well documented and verified.
In the centuries since, our obsession with how clues to a person's character might be hidden in their face has continued.
Minds have known that we can understand ourselves by understanding our structure. Learning about face reading will help you to know and understand yourself and your behaviour, and to understand the behaviour of other people without taking the behaviour personally.
Once the sole preserve of mystics, the question of whether a person's face really reflects their personality and how we form first impressions based on faces is now coming under scientific scrutiny.
So the idea is that even though there's an infinite number of possible identities for different faces, all of the variability amongst these faces can be captured by just around 50 dimensions.
We tend to like and trust faces that are typical and distrust atypical faces, and that very much depends. Imagine we have studies done, for example, in Israel and Japan, and you can construct a typical Japanese face and a typical Israeli face, and they look very different. For Japanese, the face becomes more trustworthy as it resembles more a Japanese face, and the other way around for Israelis.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly. Hi, Doris. It's Hannah here at The Guardian.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Can you hear me?
Before we come on to first impressions, we decided to look at the basic neuroscience of how we process faces.
Okay. Tea and a croissant.
This is Professor Doris Tsao.
I'm a professor of biology at Caltech, as well as the investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and also I'm the director of the Chen Center for Systems Neuroscience at Caltech.
I spoke to Doris via Skype this week and started by asking her about the competing theories around how humans process faces, including the so-called grandmother cell hypothesis.
So the big mystery is, how do we encode all the different identities that we see? And one very simple idea was that maybe there's a different neuron responsible for coding each person. And of course, this seems somewhat preposterous and it's a caricatured version. But in fact, about 10 years ago, scientists actually found single cells in the medial temporal lobe, which is a part of the brain that cares about memory, which would respond extremely selectively. So there's this famous neuron called the Jennifer Aniston neuron that these scientists recorded from that responded only to the face of Jennifer Aniston and not to, say, Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie. And it even responded also to the letter string of her name and the sound of her voice. So it wasn't purely a visual, face cell. But nevertheless, it suggested the possibility that cells could be like grandmother cells, just coding this one identity.
And until now, even though we had these ideas about how it might have done it, the exact mechanism has been seen as very intractable. It's been one of those black boxes in neuroscience. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So there was this cartoon idea out there about grandmother cells, but really we didn't have a clear notion at all what the brain solution is to coding, you know, the infinite number of different identities that we can see. I mean, we knew that there's these regions in the brain that are specialized for processing faces, right? So, and that, because they respond much more to faces and other objects in fMRI experiments. So these are experiments where you're scanning the entire brain and you're just asking, you know, which part of the brain does blood flow to when you're, say, seeing faces, right? And so we found these regions that were face selective. But it was really unclear what exactly was happening in these regions that gives rise to our percept of facial identity.
I guess that's one of the things that I think is really impressive about your paper, is that it seems as though we've gone from it almost being a black box to pretty much completely understanding the process of how we identify a face. And what you found was very different from this grandmother cell idea, wasn't it?
Yeah. So we found that the brain uses this code that in retrospect is extremely simple and makes total sense. And it's not grandmother cells. So in fact, the way the cells are coding faces is that each cell is responsible for coding a specific axis in face space. And I should probably break that down. So the idea is that even though there's an infinite number of possible identities for different faces, all of the variability amongst these faces can be captured by just around 50 dimensions, right? And so this is the same as, you know, just there's an infinite number of points, say, on a globe, yeah? But you can capture all of the variability in these points by just two axes, right? Latitude and longitude.
And in face space, so when you talk about dimensions, you're not talking about the normal spatial dimensions that we're familiar with. Those dimensions are measurements that you could take on any person's face that would tell you something about how it differed from the average face. Is that right?
Yeah, you put that very well. They're not spatial dimensions. Now they become dimensions of faces. For example, the distance between the eyes, or how dark your complexion is, how long your hair is. And these dimensions are actually even more abstract than that. They don't correspond to specific nameable features.
Doris was initially just looking for a neat mathematical way of describing faces. It was only when she started using this model in an experiment using monkeys that she realized she cracked the question of how the brain processes faces.
So we took this 50-dimensional face space, right, where you can describe every face with just 50 numbers, and we picked 2,000 random faces from this space. Okay, it's just 2,000 random points, basically, and each point is 50 numbers. Also, we were recording from monkeys, and it turns out that monkeys, like humans, have these areas that are dedicated to face processing that you can find with fMRI. And now in the monkey, we're using an electrode to record the electrical activity of single neurons, right? Each one of these areas contains, 10,000 or 100,000 face cells, yeah? And we showed these 2,000 faces to the monkey. And what we found was that there was an extraordinarily simple transformation between the responses of the cells, right, these electrical signals that they were firing, and the features of the face that we were showing. And specifically, what we found was that each cell seemed to be measuring the face along a specific axis in this 50-dimensional face space. So it's sort of analogous to, say, lines of latitude and longitude. So you have all these points on this sphere, and each cell is just looking at one axis. Say it's just measuring the latitude, or it's just measuring the longitude, or it's here, in this case, it's just measuring, you know, the inter-eye distance or the complexion. And as I mentioned before, there's a slight simplification because the axes that the actual cells cared about were not nameable features. But nevertheless, they were single dimensions.
Right. And can you just tell us a bit about how you proved for sure that you'd really nailed what the brain is doing?
Yeah, so this was one of the most satisfying aspects of the studies because we showed it in two different ways, right? So the first way is that, you know, once if we assume that the cell is measuring face along a specific axis, then we recorded from about 200 cells, and we learned which axis each of these 200 cells is measuring. And then we could show the monkey a completely new face. And we could actually reconstruct that face using the electrical activity of these 200 cells together with our knowledge of which axes each cell was measuring, right? So we could show a monkey, you know, a completely new face, and we could reconstruct it using just 200 cells. So that was quite remarkable.
These reconstructions are incredibly and eerily accurate. And if you want to take a look, we've included a link to my news article on Doris's paper on the Guardian website. For most people, these reconstructions alone would be compelling enough evidence. But Doris and her team carried out a battery of tests to convince themselves that they'd found the answer.
And then the second way that we proved this was it had a more abstract motivation, because we realized that if the cell is indeed measuring faces along just one axis, that means I should be blind to changes along all the other axes, right? And for, you know, the math types out there, if we have a 50-dimensional space and we're measuring along one axis, then there's going to be 49 other dimensions that are orthogonal to that axis, right? So basically, the cell should be blind to changes in the face that occur within a 49-dimensional hyperplane. So that's a huge space of faces that the cell should judge as identical, right? And this was extremely counterintuitive prediction because, as I said at the beginning, everyone had this notion that face cells should somehow be coding specific identities, right? And here we have this hypothesis that we should be able to generate faces that look like completely different identities, and the cell should respond exactly the same to them.
So for the non-mathsy people, would that be something similar to if you had a cell that was just sensitive to, say, the angle between the nose and the edge of the mouth? You could change everything else about a face, how dark or fair it is, the size of the eyes. But if you kept that one factor the same, that neuron would respond in the same way.
Exactly, yeah. And so we tested this and we found that it was true. So, you know, after we learned the axis that the cell cared about, we generated faces that had variability, you know, that was orthogonal to this axis, and the cells were indeed blind to all of those changes.
So it's almost the opposite of the grammar of the cell, because it's such an abstract thing that they're responding to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the brain is doing something more abstract than, you know, our naive intuition would lead us to believe. But, you know, it's not surprising why we were led to believe this, right? Because what we perceive as human beings is the result of all of the neurons, right? And the brain is somehow putting together all of these measurements so that we can see any person and see their distinctive identity. And so we don't have direct access to what each individual cell is doing. But in retrospect, this is a much more efficient code for faces than, say, trying to code every single person with a different cell.
After this short break, we'll hear about how this impressive ability to process faces leads to often wrong first impressions about the characters behind them.
So some of the most important judgments that we make about a person's trustworthiness and the person's dominance, and this is something that we do fairly rapidly and fairly automatically.
We'll be right back.
Create a beautiful website with Squarespace's all-in-one platform. There's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade, ever. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GuardianScience to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we heard from Professor Doris Tsao, the author of a recent paper that tackled how the brain processes faces.
Yeah, I'm vegetarian now. I don't feel I've earned the stripes yet.
But what about how we use that information to form first impressions?
Anyway, are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
After my talk about eggs.
This question is the focus of a recent book called Face Value.
Including in the field I work of discovering what are the stereotypes behind different kinds of facial impressions.
This is Alex Todorov.
I'm Alex Todorov. I'm professor of psychology at Princeton University.
Alex is also the author of Face Value, and he sat down recently in the studio with producer Max.
Once called the most entertaining surface on Earth, what meaning can we sort of get from faces?
Well, faces are really incredibly rich stimuli, and we just can't help but look at faces. It's attention to faces is essentially reflexive. If you tell people don't look at faces, well, they can't help it. And they immediately attract our attention. And there are many things that we extract from facial information, although often there's inherent ambiguity, but broad categories like gender, age, ethnicity, something that we get very rapidly, attractiveness, and emotional expressions, mental state, whether the people are tired. The problem is that we also often make attributions that are supposed to describe the person in general and generalize across time and situation. So some of the most important judgments that we make about a person's trustworthiness and the person's dominance. And this is something that we do fairly rapidly and fairly automatically.
And is because you hear people sort of bandying around this idea of, you know, 15 seconds and you know whether you like someone or whether you're attracted to them or whether you trust them. Is that true, the 15-second thing?
Well, it is true only to an extent. It is true to the extent that you really have this response. We have conducted many studies where you can present faces for extremely brief amount of time. So we're talking of the order of 1/10 of a second. And even after this extremely brief exposure, where it's very hard to see clearly any kinds of features, it provides sufficient time for people to know whether they like the face, whether they trust the face, and for people to make all kinds of complex attributions. So this is true. We do have evaluative responses to just about anything in the world. And I think it comes as part natural part of perception. It is not true in the sense that if you have this response, it really reflects what is true about the person. Because the person just might have a bad day. They might be sleep deprived. There's tons of things that we are perfectly aware for our own self, because some days you're tired, some days you had an argument with a friend or with a spouse or whatever, and there are lots of situational things that could make us not look at our best or behave at our best, and we know it doesn't describe us the way we are most of the time, but it is kind of difficult to see it when you're on the other side and perceiving somebody who doesn't seem that they seem a bit disgruntled and a bit rude and whatnot. And then we are very willing in this particular case to jump to attributions. Well, this person seems like a real jerk.
Alex's work suggests that first impressions are highly unreliable. Despite this, people tend to agree on them. Take trustworthiness, for example.
It's actually hard to describe it verbally, and this is one reason my book is very richly illustrated, because we are able to build mathematical models of these impressions, which essentially visualize exactly what are the features that go into our impression of trustworthiness. And if you look, we have movies on my lab website, and then lots of things change. So the best you can do is verbally is to say, well, here are the global characteristics. So one of the most important and salient ones is emotional expressions. And we're not talking about baring your teeth to show that you're angry or, you know, grinning, But essentially, as you are increasing the perceived trustworthiness of a face, and we can do this with our models, the face start having more and more positive expressions. And if you're decreasing the perceived trustworthiness, the face has this disgruntled, angry-looking expressions. And in fact, at some point, they don't see these faces as so-called emotionally neutral, but they see us expressing emotion. So this is post hoc, makes a lot of sense, because welcoming expressions signal you can approach me and you can talk to me. And if somebody is kind of looking really angry, you better get out of their way. A second input is femininity, masculinity of the face. On average, we tend to trust more feminine than masculine faces, and it goes along with a number of gender stereotypes that are true across many cultures.
And something that you sort of mentioned in the book, and I know there's been a lot of research done on, is the role of these sort of first impressions and faces specifically within sort of impressions of political leaders or politicians. What are some of the findings in that field?
Yes, in fact, the very first studies that we did with impressions from faces was trying to see whether these impressions can predict the electoral success of United States politicians. And we did this over 10 years ago, and this is what really got me interested in starting first impressions. So in this particular case, we will show participants pictures of politicians, typically the winner and the runner-up for a U.S. Senate election race. And the participants don't even know that they're looking at politicians. And we use only data for politicians that they don't recognize. And we ask them to make various judgments, but the one that really matters is who looks more competent. And so if you aggregate across a number of participants with these competence judgments, we can predict about 70% of the election outcomes. And in fact, there's a nice linear relationship between the margin of victory and the difference in perceived competence between the two candidates. So this is kind of, and since then there have been a lot of dozens of international replications, when often you will have people from one country making judgment of politicians from another country, not having any idea who these people are, and you would still find this positive relationship between appearance and electoral success.
And am I right in thinking, I vaguely remember reading something that they did it with children?
Yes, this was my favorite replication, which was done in Switzerland shortly after our study was published, and they work with children, and obviously it seems kind of weird to ask children, well, look at these two guys, who looks more competent or more intelligent? So they had a kind of a game situation. They described to the kids the Odysseus trip to Ithaca, and then they told the kids, well, now imagine that you have a really difficult voyage, and here are two guys, possible captains. You gotta pick up the captain of your ship. Who's going to be the captain? And children, just like adults, in the majority of the cases, picked the captain, who happened to be a French politician who won the particular French parliamentary election. And this was Swiss children, so clearly it wasn't about exposure, familiarity with the politicians.
But how does this work across the world, where in different countries, the average facial features might be very different?
We tend to like and trust faces that are typical and distrust atypical faces, and that very much depends. Imagine we have studies done, for example, in Israel and Japan, you know, and you can construct a typical Japanese face and a typical Israeli face, and they look very different. For Japanese, the face becomes more trustworthy as it resembles more a Japanese face, and the other way around for Israelis. So this is one thing. Then there are other things that would be very specific to you. For example, we tend to like faces that resemble faces that we already like. So you can have people learn different evaluative facts about random faces. And then if you ask them to evaluate novel faces which actually have subtle resemblance to the faces that you learned, and you can do this with morphing, people, although they don't explicitly recognize the similarity, they tend to like faces that resemble faces already associated with some positive information, and dislike faces associated with negative information. So in everyday life, I mean, you see people, and if they resemble somebody you like, your first impression would tend to be positive. And given that we all have different looking friends, this is most likely it's not going to converge across people. It just would be very specific to any individual.
So beauty is in the eye of the beholder then?
To a large extent, actually. I mean, there's been Some work trying to statistically estimate what are the contributions, how much is shared, and how much is it comes from you. And the more generous estimate is that 50-50, although we agree, and depending how you do the analysis, in fact, if anything, there is more of a idiosyncratic contributions than shared contribution, really in the eye of the beholder.
After this short break, we'll hear why making snap judgments about others based on their appearance can be undesirable.
People are so overconfident in their facial impressions that they go for the wrong judgment.
Don't go anywhere. Before we kick off again, we wanted to recommend another of our podcasts here at The Guardian. It's called Football Weekly and sees James Richardson and the Football Weekly team bring you a twice-weekly dose of puns and punditry from the Premier League and beyond. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Football Weekly on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. Before the break, we heard from Alex Todorov, psychologist and author of Face Value, about the impressions we all make based on the faces we see.
Part of your book looks at how we sort of may misrepresent.
But given that we often jump to the same conclusions, is there at least a sliver of truth in these old ideas of physiognomy?
In some ways, there has been a revival of the physiognomist ideas in the past decade, and I think partly this was fueled by progress in figuring out what's behind the stereotypes of different facial impressions. So the logic goes, well, if I can figure out what are the relations between impressions and appearance, perhaps now these are the right tools to figure out, and maybe these impressions lead to a real personality inferences. And there has been a lot of studies showing that presumably we can guess better than chance political orientation, sexual orientation, and all kinds of things. And in fact, yes, we can do better than chance, but barely. And we provide lots of examples that better than chance, it's a really lousy criterion for accuracy, because in many situations, you can just use generic knowledge about the world and you will do much better than these judgments. But people are so overconfident, even when you have a very good statistical information to the contrary, people are so overconfident in their facial impressions that they go for the wrong judgment. And the danger is if you really trust these judgments and if you act on these judgments, and there are lots of work showing that they have serious consequences. And this is actually the main reason I have four chapters dedicated to the question of accuracy.
And one of those chapters sort of looks at our evolutionary past and the role that this plays in all this. What can that tell us?
There's been a lot of evolutionary inspired theories about maybe there is something in our faces that perhaps it's really, it signals our biological fitness. And my reading of the literature is that, well, obviously there are lots of changes and sexual dimorphism is important and men differ from women and the structure of men's faces is somewhat different than women's faces, but there's many other information also in the body, upper physical strength that is much more easily accessible. And I don't think that there is much evolutionary evidence that there's something special in our faces that conveys real character. I mean, one way to think about it is, well, let's look at evolutionary history and let's imagine that human evolution is compressed within 24 hours. Well, except for the last 5 minutes of the day, we've basically lived in large extended families, 5 to 100 individuals. And in these small communities, you pretty much have lots of knowledge about every single person, not only from first-hand information, experiences, but second-hand accounts of friends, relatives. And you don't really need to rely on first impressions to size up the others. And physiognomy really disappears when you have modern states where you really live with a lot of strangers. Jared Diamond had a great line that this was the first time in human history when you have to encounter strangers without attempting to kill them. It's that simple like that. And this is a bit scary. And for me, first impression, in a sense, they serve psychological functions just like stereotypes. They make life seems a little bit more controllable. You can look at people and presumably you immediately have some idea and some knowledge about them.
And so do you think then that potentially we need to try and sort of move away from first impressions or our confidence in these first impressions?
Definitely, especially if the decision is important. If you're hiring somebody, if you're making decisions, you move to a new neighborhood, a new house, what your new neighbors are like, well, these are relationships that are consequential. So you would be better off if you consult other more reliable information than count on your first impression.
This is probably easier said than done. And as someone who dedicates his life to looking into these issues, has Alex changed his own approach to how he judges people he meets?
I think that we get a lot of information from the face, but it is about here and now. And I really stray away from making any kinds of inferences. I mean, here's a specific example. So pretty much almost every year, if not every other year, we admit graduate students. I mean, my job as a professor is also to train graduate students, and all of my research has been done with a lot of students, and they're all mentioned in my book. And we interview them, although we have all of the information. Well, we've known for over 40 years that unstructured interviews, which are exactly the interviews we do, are practically useless in predicting performance. They're just bad. I mean, and people who are naturally shy, they don't do well in this kind of situation, which is anxiety-provoking. So I refuse to provide feedback and say, well, that's what I think about this candidate based on my interview. When I'm admitting a student, I know whether I want them before they show up at my door. I mean, yes, I have all of the information. I got their past performance, I got their CV, I got their letters of reference, I got their test scores. This is all you need. And then your first impressions can just lead you astray. And they do in many situations. So, I mean, if it's an important decision, and in this case, I'm going to spend 5 years with this person, and in fact, I always joke that once they're in your lab, they never leave you, because then you write letters. And this is a long-term relationship. It's part of the family. And then I think you're much better off leaving aside your first impression and really thinking, well, what sort of evidence do I have that they will do perform well in this particular situation?
So before we go to dinner party, we should get all the guests to send us a page about themselves.
Well, that's a whole different thing. So that's why I said it's kind of, it very much depends on the circumstances. So you walk into a party and you immediately know, oh, okay, I want to talk to this person. I'm not interested in talking to these other people. And maybe you're totally wrong. Maybe you missed your chance to, you know, meet your future spouse, who is this absolutely terrific, amazing person. That's quite possible. But at the same time, it's probably not very consequential. You know, you're at the party to have fun. I mean, you don't have, so it's okay. And walking into a party, I mean, the thing is that we never interact with disembodied faces. And this is what we've studied. But how we dress, how you groom, it's all very strategic and in fact provides a lot of information for your social groups or your aspired social groups. So this is all very useful information. I mean, in a sense, much more useful than what you see in the face. And these are things that we easily change. And this is something that, in fact, is part of our personality. So in that case, maybe it's okay. I mean, whatever your first impression is.
So look at the shoes, not the face.
Shoes could be important. For some people, they're extremely important.
Special thanks this week to Professor Doris Tsao and Professor Alex Todorov. We'll include a link to Alex's book, as well as a link to my original article on Doris's study, in the episode's description on the Guardian website. I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.